This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Practical for Your Practice podcast. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz, joined today by my friend Kevin Holloway. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm great, Corinne. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm excited because I have one of my favorite people as our guest today. Although I realize I say that a lot. I say like my
favorite. You have a lot of favorite people.
I have so many favorites.
and that's okay.
I like a lot of people. People are great. I'm excited about our topic today, but I know that we are starting with a listener question today. So what do you got for us?
Well, we love all the questions coming in, by the way. And so we'll give you information in the show notes how to send us a question too, if you'd like. But our question today is from Alyssa from Macon, and I assume Georgia, but there may be other Macons.
Hi, Alyssa.
So her question is, why don't you all do video for the podcast? Some of us would love to see your guests.
Just our guests.
Right. I think they have mental pictures of us already, I'm sure. So great question. And, I think there's a lot of podcasts out there that have video. You can see like a version on YouTube or other platforms. We've decided for a couple of reasons, and this is just like kind of like behind the scenes weirdness maybe, is that we don't do video because, number one, it makes our guests more comfortable. Yeah. Like we don't have to worry about what is our face doing or how we're dressed or what's my hair doing out there. And it makes it easier to edit the final product because audio editing, we can do stuff and cut out pieces and it sounds like it's a nice flow. If we're cutting out video, there's sometimes this weird edit, cut, and a jump, or I don't know, something like that. So just for all of those reasons, it makes us look better if we don't do video. How's that?
I was going to say a much simpler answer. I do think our guests definitely prefer that we don't have video. So do I. I mean, I had to brush my hair today because I knew we were going to do video for the listener question. I had to brush my hair and put on lipstick. And that's just a lot of work. I don't like to work that hard.
We'd rather focus on the guest than the topic, right?
That's what it is. I want to focus on our great topic. That's what it is. It has nothing to do with my own vanity, for sure.
And that's recorded now. So it's like gospel.
But Alyssa, that was a great question. And I hope you appreciate the irony of us recording video as we answer that question.
Absolutely.
We hope that you'll send more questions in and more comments. And of course, check out our show notes for information on how to get in touch with us and send us your comments and questions so we can include them in another episode. But let's talk about today's episode, which, like I said, I'm really excited about because it is not only is it one of my favorite people as a guest, but it's also a topic that comes up constantly in our sleep disorders workshops, which is the question about using sleep trackers. What are they good for, if anything, in treatment? And to help us answer that question, we have a returning guest from CDP, Dr. Diana Dolan. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Diana.
Hi, Corinne. Hi, Kevin. I'm so glad you all have me back.
Welcome back. It must mean you were a good guest the other times that you've been on. For those of our listeners who maybe haven't listened to your episodes before, would you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Diana Dolan. I'm a clinical psychologist and associate director at the Center for Deployment Psychology in my official hat. But I generally consider myself a sleep nerd, which is why I'm here today. So I have training in behavioral sleep medicine from graduate school, and then I was active duty Air Force and have gotten a chance in my career to work in civilian sleep medicine clinics, military sleep medicine clinics, general mental health, primary care settings. So a lot of different opportunities to see the ways in which sleep goes wrong, I guess.
Right.
And I also have a diplomat in behavioral sleep medicine from the Board of Behavioral Sleep Medicine. So Clearly very interested and excited about sleep and sleeping well. That doesn't mean that I necessarily sleep well. I'm excited that some people may get the opportunity to sleep well. And I hope that what I've learned and what I've passed on can help other people do that.
Diana, I love that you say that. It doesn't necessarily mean that you sleep well, because I don't know if this is true. And Corinne and Diana, tell me if you've experienced this too. A lot of people that I've met that specialize in sleep and behavioral medicine, particularly focusing on sleep, they themselves have said that either they got started in the field because they had their own sleep difficulties, or even now they still struggle with sleep. Is that common?
You know what's funny, Kevin, is I actually think that I slept well when I got into the field. And now maybe I question too much, kind of like you take one of those diagnostic courses, right? Like, oh, is this diagnosable?
I don't know. For me, it was definitely the case that I got into sleep treatment, insomnia in particular, sort of by accident. I was sort of forced to, but it was interesting to me because I absolutely have struggled with insomnia my whole life. And on the flip side, I can say that CBTI actually worked for me. Like,
excellent.
So that's the positive, and I can say that to people with 100% genuineness.
Practice what you preach.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in terms of practicing what we preach, that is actually very relevant to this topic that we're going to talk about. So a question that comes up constantly, as I said, in our workshops about sleep disorders, is the role of sleep wearables. So things like our Apple Watches and Aura Rings and Fitbit and all that kind of stuff, right? Like questions come up constantly about it. And it's relevant because when the Jawbone Fit, whatever it was, I think, I forget what it was even called. Was that the Fitbit? When that came out, I was obsessed with it and I used it all the time. And I have since stopped using them. So very relevant to this topic. Let's talk about the good, bad, and the ugly with sleep trackers, maybe starting with what they even are and how we define them.
Oh, all right. Well, let's just jump in then. I do want to note that there's definitely some heated debate on this topic. So I will try to cover all the sides that I can fairly. But that's a great question to start with, Corinne, is what are we even talking about, right? And you gave some great examples of some of the devices. So folks may have heard about devices that are home sleep apnea testing, for example, or ambulatory polysomnography, or PSG. These are devices that have a lot of multiple different sensors and EEG components and things like that. These are validated. They go through validation. Insurance has to decide whether or not to cover them. They are used clinically, right, for a sleep medicine physician to make a diagnosis of sleep apnea. So these are things that are medical devices in that sense. And I want to differentiate those from what we're talking about today, which we use the term wearables more broadly. These are things that are primarily intended for consumer use, and wearables don't collect things like EEG, but we can get a lot of cool things nowadays, light, movement, a proxy for heart rate, skin temperature, skin conductance, those kinds of things. And so again, Corinne, the examples you gave are great, like an Apple Watch, a Fitbit, the Aura Ring. Those are the kinds of things that we're talking about today.
I love that differentiation. I think a lot of us kind of assume that the devices, the wearable devices that we have, because you know they're advertised as such, can tell us perhaps more accurately than they can. And so, you know, certainly I've had a lot of clients, even, you know, friends that will swear by, much like Corinne did with her Jawbone, right? That, you know, we got to be tracking this really closely and this is going to give me all sorts of information. And it gives some. I mean, I don't want to be throwing them out under the bus, but it sounds like there may be some, I don't know, some gap maybe in between the kind of the consumer market for wearables and the kind of validated instruments that you mentioned as well. So it makes me wonder, like, what concerns do you have? I mean, if there's this gap in the kind of data that's collected, what concerns does that lead to?
Yeah, and that's also an interesting question, Kevin, because I've been thinking about it. I'm going to give y'all a different answer today than I would have given maybe even 2-3 years ago.
Okay.
Because the field is just evolving so rapidly, which is really interesting. So, you know, again, thinking of consumer wearables, this idea of tracking sleep, and originally it was known as actigraphy, right? That we're measuring sleep by movement. That's actually been around since the late 70s, early 80s. But this whole wearable era that we're talking about didn't really kick off until it was the Jawbone. I think it was the Up. And that was,
Up, believe that's it what or it not, was.
Yeah, the Up. Believe it or not, y'all, that was only 13 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Even in that short time frame, though, consumer wearables have really come a long way. So the early ones were a lot less accurate than the ones nowadays are. And so, you know, do I think moving into the future that things will continue to get even better? Yes. So things have come a long way. That said, I will tell you, consumer wearables are still only about 50 to 70% accurate in identifying sleep staging. I'm not talking about other things, daytime measures or anything like that, but in terms of accurately measuring sleep staging, is this stage one? Is the person awake? Is the person asleep? However, you know, we could go back and forth and debate on that all day. There's literally study after study of looking at this particular device or this particular device with that algorithm. It's like playing whack-a-mole because there's constantly new devices and new software updates being released. I think for me, the bigger question and my concern about these from a clinical perspective is less about accuracy, although that's a problem. 50 to 70% could be a lot better. Right. It's more about how are patients using these when they come into treatment. So, you know, do patients want to use these to the exclusion of other clinically relevant assessments?
That really, it's a fascinating question because like you said, like these have only been on the market for a short time. I think you said 13 years, right? And so maybe, you know, a question that occurs to me and let me back up a little bit is like, what is so fascinating about these devices for folks? Because, you know, it was really common for a long time with a lot of my clients that they would say things like, I don't need to get a sleep study. I don't need to get testing. I know when I'm asleep and I'm not sleeping. Like there's this kind of this confidence in their own ability to assess how well they're sleeping. And it suggests there's maybe also some missing data there too. Like are people very good, I don't know, evaluators of their own sleep quality, sleep, you know, amount?
And you know, how much credence are they giving the device?
Right.
Over what they're learning in treatment. Yeah. And it's interesting too, there's the well-known idea of sleep state misperception for people with insomnia, right? Where they are, if you put them in an official gold standard PSG study, right, you would see that they're asleep, but they'll tell you they're awake. And so we refer to this as sleep state misperception. It's very common in people with insomnia. And the question I often ask in clinical treatment and training, when I'm training providers up, for example, in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is, does that matter? Does it matter if they're misperceiving things because they think they're not sleeping well?
Right.
And so we can help them. But now wearables have introduced this other layer to the question, right? Maybe the patient thought they were doing okay. And maybe some of this anxiety about sleep and sleep state misperception is being induced by the device.
Right.
That came up recently in a consultation question that I had actually that I was working with a provider who's working with a patient doing CBTI. And the patient was becoming increasingly anxious because they thought they were doing better, but the tracker was not reflecting that. And the tracker was saying something else, that they weren't getting more sleep or they weren't, whatever it was, they weren't getting deeper stages of sleep. And the progress that that patient was actually objectively making in CBTI was being undermined by this data that was being outputted by the smartwatch. And so it absolutely added more anxiety into the process. It didn't matter how accurate it was because it was just making the patient more anxious, which of course then was getting in the way of sleep and making them more skeptical about the treatment itself.
That is fascinating.
So we worked on how do we talk to the patient about this to stop relying on that fitness tracker and instead rely more on their own assessment.
Right. So the wearable was changing their own thoughts about their sleep, maybe even the patient's behavior, right?
Yeah.
Willingness to engage in treatment. Yeah.
But I also want to go back to Kevin's question about like, why do we care? Why are we as a society so excited about these things? I've never stopped to think about that before. And now that's all I can think about.
You're welcome.
I'm realizing how gamified this has become. Because that, I guess the other piece is, what a contradiction that one of the things we run into in insomnia treatment the most is that patients don't want to use a sleep log. They find it cumbersome. They get annoyed by it. They don't want to track their sleep.
Yeah.
And yet often they love their sleep tracker. They love their wearable. They love their fitness tracker. And I'm thinking about my own, which I use mostly just for exercise at this point, but I love looking at the app and seeing, you know, oh, where was my heart rate during that jog and how far did I go and what was my pace? And it becomes a little bit addictive. I think at the very least, it becomes really engaging in a way that's different from tracking my sleep on a sleep log and shading in the boxes by hand.
Yeah. And part of it is gamification. People are interested in that. But I also think we're talking about two different kinds of self-monitoring. The wearables are passive. You don't have to do anything other than make sure they're charged. A sleep log takes active intention, active effort, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, some of that is a gauge of motivation of where the patient's at, and maybe willingness to make change. Because if it's hard to keep a sleep log, how hard is it going to be to get out of bed in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. or to follow some of these things? So it's definitely insightful for me, the extent to which folks are kind of stuck or maybe fixated on the wearable versus more open to making change. And to your point, Corinne, there was an interesting study that came out about a year and a half ago, and they were looking at, does simply giving people feedback about their sleep from a wearable improve their sleep without CBTI or anything like that? And the comparison group was sleep hygiene, of course. It always is, right?
Always.
And what they found is very interesting. Feedback from the device changed insomnia severity index scores somewhat. It wasn't like gigantic, but had an impact. So people were self-rating their insomnia severity a little bit better. But it didn't change, whether as measured by the patient or the wearable, it didn't change their sleep onset latency, their wake after sleep onset, their total sleep time.
Interesting.
Didn't change their daytime function or their measures of mood or anxiety.
So feedback in and of itself didn't change the sleep, the pattern at all. It just maybe made the person a little more aware, or like they could talk about it more accurately or knowledgeably. Is that what we're saying?
They felt a little less distressed, even though nothing changed.
That's
and so maybe that speaks to, again, the gamification, Corinne, maybe feeling more in control of your body or your data or what have you.
So interesting. So these are all of the potential negatives that come along with wearables. I think we've covered those pretty well.
About that.
Although I'm pretty sure that Diana and I both, as fellow sleep nerds, could keep going forever on that topic. Let me ask, is there any way in which you imagine that these tools could be helpful for treatment or assessment?
So I have to have a balanced view, right? I said I would try to present multiple perspectives. So I do think there's a couple ways in which wearables can be helpful for treatment. To start with, and Kevin, you did a great job of pointing this out, kind of goes back to that motivation piece, right? If folks are motivated to be interested in their sleep data, then that tells me that at least there's something there that says they're concerned about their sleep. Right. And so that, I think, is something we can build on. Like, you're using this because you genuinely want to know more about your sleep and you're concerned about where your sleep is. And so I think that's one way that it's helpful, is that it gives us a starting point to acknowledge we're on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah. We're working towards the same goal.
We're working towards the same goal, right? And so I think that's kind of the focus for me. We can also talk about the idea that we're not going to take away. I'm not going to tell someone to stop using their wearable as part of treatment, right?
Yeah.
So I could say to them, you know, would you be willing to try treatment at the same time you're still tracking your sleep with the wearable? And use that existing motivation they have with that piggyback and kind of jumpstart treatment there, if you will. Now, in the back of my head, I may know maybe this isn't the most accurate device or something like that. But in terms of how we leverage it and how it's presented to them, I'm not necessarily going to put them on the spot for that piece of it.
And you've started to answer part of or my next question, which is, what advice would you have for providers whose patients want to use the wearables? At least in my experience, that is an issue that comes up frequently, that patients are engaged and interested in those wearables for any of the reasons that we just described, and they want to keep using them. And Diana, as you said, that it's easier, it's passive, it's already happening, that tracking is already happening. And that's preferable to actually have to actively track sleep. So my point, in a very long rambling way, is that the question comes up frequently, patients want to use it. So what advice would you have for providers on how to talk with patients about that?
Yeah, I think the advice I would have would be to talk with the patient more, to find out and explore with the patient what it is they like about the device. Because there's different reasons people are using wearables, right? Is it that the patient really likes feedback? Corinne, you talked about, I like to get feedback on my run. And maybe having that feedback, it doesn't have to be 100% accurate, your heart rate, but that feedback is so interesting that it makes you go on the next run.
Yes.
Right. So is it that you like getting feedback? If that's the case, then I would recommend that the clinician talk with the patient to really see more about, all right, well, I have clinical tools like your wearable, that's the sleep log. And it'd be really interesting to see how both your sleep log and your wearable vary with treatment. So to fold in the idea of you're getting feedback with what I'm asking you to do in treatment, and to make sure that you're giving the patient feedback in treatment.
Motivate the compliance. Yeah.
Motivate the compliance. Exactly. Is it that the person likes the wearables because they like seeing the data plotted out? Is it more about kind of the numbers and the cool spiffy graphs and all of that? Then maybe as a clinician, you might be more likely to recommend an app-based sleep log for them. It's still a sleep log that involves their active effort, their inputting the data, but they can on their own explore some of those graphs and things. Or if they don't want to do that, maybe you go old school and plot their data for them. I have done that for patients where I have a chart and each week we plot out, here's your total sleep time. Here's how it compares to your time in bed. So kind of looking at what interests the patient about it. The other thing I think that strikes me about wearables that I think clinicians can talk with their patients about is, what are their expectations for the wearable? Mm. What is it that the patient wants to get out of using it?
Yeah.
And then I like to make things conversational with the patient rather than telling them, try to elicit as much as I can out of them or make it more conversational. What are your expectations? When they tell me their expectations, I ask them, how do you think that might be impacting your health right now? How do you think that might impact treatment with me?
Those are great questions and ways to talk about it, that some of which I had not thought of myself. So thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I have a weird question I'm going to throw at you. And if this is not a thing, just go ahead and tell me that. But I wonder too, do you ever run across clients, patients who, we talked about gamification, but maybe in a different way, maybe try to game the tracker, right? Like I'm thinking of like the person who attaches his Fitbit to the cat so that it looks like he has all these extra steps or whatever. But I mean, and I'll tell you the reason I have this question is a good friend of mine, also a psychologist who specializes in sleep, many years ago had gotten a hold of an actigraph, like a clinical actigraph, had been validated, all of that. But before he started lending it out to patients to start collecting this data, he wanted to see in what ways could it be gamed, if you will. And so like he took it home, attached it to a ceiling fan and let it run all night kind of thing, just to see what would happen to the data. And if I remember correctly, this was a rather sophisticated device. And so in the morning, the feedback was something like, yeah, nice try. You apparently attached this to a ceiling fan, you know, or something like that. But I wonder, you know, how often you come across clients who maybe for whatever motivation are maybe trying to, I don't know, game the data that's coming from a tracker or wearable.
Yeah, well, you certainly can game the data on a sleep wearable. That's because the biggest point of weakness for wearables is miscoding wake as sleep.
Mm.
And that's something that I really don't know how possible it is to ever get that completely accurate. Because if you have someone who is laying very still and they're stewing and they're ruminating, right, and they're planning the next day's to-do list, the watch will code that, or the wearable will code that as sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really wanted it to look like you had 100% sleep efficiency, you just would stay in bed, not moving, which ironically is the worst thing you can do if you're having sleep problems.
But it's also what people do. I mean, people with insomnia say, well, maybe if I just lay really, really still, I'll fall asleep. I don't want to get up. I'll just lay really, really still and try to slow down my breathing and then I'll fall asleep. So they're inadvertently even gaming the system.
Yeah.
And maybe this is where having a conversation with patients comes in, and you don't need to say this is only X percent accurate, but you can say one of the challenges with using this kind of assessment is this coding error right here. And it's going to essentially give you an overestimation of your total sleep time. It doesn't mean that the data isn't of interest, you know, and that we can't talk about that, but it does mean that I don't want you to get fixated, right, mm-hmm. on one particular proxy here. That's why we're going to have multiple different ways we collect and balance things out. But that is definitely a big area that the wearables kind of miss.
Well, I like the way you say that too. We have a number of proxies because this is, I mean, you already said this. This is not a direct measure of sleep. The wearable is not tapping into some kind of physiological signal of sleep. What it's doing is it's measuring movement, or it's measuring, like you said, heart rate or other kinds of things, and making a best guess based on the very indirect data. And sometimes the guesses are wrong. In fact, it sounds like sometimes they're very wrong and encode exactly the opposite of what's happening, just because this isn't a direct measurement.
Exactly. Like the output data that we see, like Corinne, you and I have to admit, I went and looked at my sleep before coming on this podcast. Like, how does my app look? And I know it was off. Like, I know it's telling me I slept more than I did. You know, so it's definitely known that the raw data that the wearables collect has to go through some kind of algorithm, and each wearable mm-hmm. has its own proprietary algorithm, right? That mm-hmm. they companies often don't disclose to sleep researchers. And then they put this output of sleep stages, but the wearables aren't actually measuring EEG activity or the things right. that we use to define those stages. That's a great point.
I have to say, just funny aside, that as I said, I still use my my tracker, my watch. I don't even have it on now. I only use it when I'm working out. So the rest of the time it's on my dresser, on the other side of my bedroom, whatever. And it still tracks my sleep at night. So in the morning, it'll still tell me, oh, you didn't sleep that well last night. You only slept 2 hours, but it's been on my dresser, not on my wrist the entire night.
Wow.
So I have to say, I don't think it's totally accurate. Well, Diana, thank you so much for giving us this.
Yeah.
What I would say is actually an introduction to talking about wearables, because there's so much more we could say about it. And as you said, our answers about this might change from year to year as the technology changes. And it has, because we've talked about this years ago and our opinions were a little bit different back then. I want to transition us a little bit to our theme for this season, which hopefully our listeners know. In season 6, we are talking about who's got your six. So we've been asking all of our guests this season to tell us who has your back in either personal or professional when you run into times of stress and complication. Who's got your six? Who do you turn to? We have two rules in answering this question.
Right.
The first is we can't name the other people on the podcast, even though we all have each other six all the time, blah, 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 blah. And when you do share who has your six, don't use their name, because then everybody who you don't mention will get mad at you. So keep it a little bit vague. But with those rules in place, who's got your six?
That's a great question. I think this may sound a little silly, but when you are in the field we do, or we are, and you move around a lot, or you get to know people and have these large networks, you don't always get to see folks in person mm-hmm. in the same way. You know, maybe you get to go to a conference once a year. So for me, what I would say is something as relatively straightforward as having a Google chat mm-hmm. of other professionals, other like-minded sleep nerds, right? And when something either crazy or silly that you just have to vent about, just being able to throw that in the chat, that and just know that people are going to validate you. I think that is very helpful. So, I think that's,
I told you not to mention names and not to mention anybody on the podcast, but I like to think I'm part of your Google chat, and I know that I am because I send you weird stuff all the time, weird stuff that's happened, and you validate me. So thanks.
Perfect. Well, another thing we always do with every episode, and those who've been listening very long will know this, is that we end each episode with what we call actionable intel. It's kind of suggestions, resources, things that our listeners can take away right now and implement right now to improve their practice. So do you have a couple of thoughts about you know, what actionable intel would you give to our listeners following this conversation today?
Incoming actionable intel.
So I think a couple of things. The first thing I would say is I would recommend folks think about wearables not necessarily as an exclusionary consideration for proceeding with behavioral sleep treatment, but as a starting point at which you can kind of leverage the motivation and to start to have more of a discussion about the patient's sleep. I think that if folks want to learn more about some of the research, because there's a lot, it's a deep dive, maybe we can link to some resources. In the podcast notes, I have some position statements and some papers that folks can take a look at.
Fantastic.
Overall, I think the bottom line with wearables is that they are, they're getting better. They have come a long way since 13 years ago. So when I think about using them, sometimes I have this anxiety if they're not perfect. I would tell folks to not worry as much about that as long as you don't use them as a replacement for the sleep log. But I will be very interested to see where things go. And I encourage folks to kind of keep an ear out, because already where consumer wearables are has eclipsed the early actigraphs to the point where Philips no longer, the Philips ActiWatch is no longer produced. And that's what I was trained on. So now I'm old, right?
Wow.
And I think things are only going to get better in terms of the sensitivity of instruments, the quality of instruments in wearables. So, you know, if you feel a little bit anxious about them, stay tuned. But I think that they can be a good starting point for treatment.
Awesome. I would add to that, if I may, one of the resources is the CBTI Coach app, one of the resources that we might consider, because Diana, you were saying if part of what patients like is being able to plot their data and get that feedback and, you know, engage with an app, the CBTI Coach app is one that we use frequently to have a reliable way to enter a sleep diary or sleep log via an app. It's a totally free app that we've talked about before. So I think we should include that in the show notes as well as a resource.
Thank you so much, Diana, for joining us. This is fascinating. I am not a sleep expert, but I'm fascinated by the topic and certainly, you know, have done a little bit of training, but this was great. This helps me to kind of organize in my head a little bit about, you know, the kind of trackers and wearables. I've got a smartwatch too that I take off at night, but I'm considering putting it back on just because I'm curious about the data that it would produce and be careful not to overinterpret it and all that kind of stuff. But really appreciate the conversation. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, for being a returning guest.
Yes.
We always appreciate having back. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in, for sending us questions. Of course, follow us on your favorite platform. Keep being in touch.
Send us emails or voicemail messages. The links for those will be in the show notes as well.
Weird Google chats, send those too.
Right. And of course, in the meantime, stay curious.
And mind your EBPs.
Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.